Welcome to the Radio Book Club, which is a monthly collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. Arsene Kashkashian, who's the head buyer at the bookstore, as always, is my co-host. And this is a very special edition of the Book Club because we're doing it for the first time at the actual bookstore itself in front of a studio audience. And it is because it's Independent Bookstore Day. This is being broadcast in May. However, we're taping it on Independent Bookstore Day. And we're here at the Boulder Bookstore with a special guest, a returning visitor to the book club, Peter Heller. Hi, Peter.
Hi, it's great to be here again.
We have selected Peter Heller for the second time, Arsene. Obviously, we're big fans of Peter and his writing, but why have you chosen Celine? Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, you know, I've been following Peter's career very closely since he started writing fiction. And this is, his latest novel. And I thought it was a different challenge for him. You know, the main character is a woman. The first two novels were really kind of from the point of view of a guy, and kind of guys. And so I was very curious to see how Peter could pull this off. And I thought it would be great fun to bring him in here for Independent Bookstore Day, and we got the audience, and I appreciate everybody being here. And so I thought we'd have a great conversation. I think he is one of the key authors we have in Colorado, and we've been really hitting upon the Colorado authors these last few months.
And Celine is the title of the book, but this is a piece of fiction. However, it really lies close to home. Peter, it was very much inspired by your mother. When you read this book, it's even more astounding because the character is so dynamic, so interesting. She's a private investigator who has this incredible family history and then has all of these incredible stories as a PI. Tell us, first of all, a little bit about your mom.
So my mom, like Celine, was born in Paris just before World War II. Her dad was a banker for Morgan's American. She fled with her two sisters and her mother just before the Germans marched in. She got to Manhattan, and her mother, my grandmother, told me that all my mom wanted to do at age 7 in Manhattan was go back to France and be in the French Resistance. And she would go around Manhattan listening to conversations really closely, trying to decide who is a Nazi spy. So she had this sort of special ops bent ever since she was a kid. And she married right out of college, like a lot of women in her generation. And I came along soon after, and I think I probably quashed her dreams of being in the CIA. But she did start working for a detective agency, and she got her PI license, and almost immediately was contacted by the FBI.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was that like growing up with a mom who had all of that going on?
Well, that wasn't even the most astounding part. I mean, she did, she could really handle a gun. She trained at the Lethal Force Institute in New Hampshire. She was a badass. She could drive. She would disappear for a couple of weeks at a time. I don't really know what she did. But she was a great artist. She was an amazing artist. She would make voodoo altars and sculptures out of bones. Her art, she lived right at the base of the Brooklyn Bridge there on the dock, on the East River, on the Brooklyn side. And she had these big windows, and people would look in and see her art and come and knock on the door and ask if it was a gallery. So she was turning people away a lot. But her window washer was so fascinated by her art that the next day he brought her a skull and a bucket, and he said, "Mrs. Heller, don't ask." So she didn't. She covered it in gold leaf immediately and put it on a pedestal by the front door where it still sits, looking elegant.
But the human skull?
Yeah.
Okay. Don't ask.
Yeah. So this is kind of the background for Celine's character. It's a book of fiction, but you've really kept those details very similar or the same. So where does the fiction begin? Where, as a writer, how do you decide how you're going to, you have this great character that's given to you, your mm-hmm. mother, you don't mm-hmm. really need to change anything. But how do you get the fiction story going? What was the impetus for that?
Yeah, I mean, so my mom died 2.5 years ago, and I was very close with her, and I was devastated. And I started writing the novel with the novel sort of begins with a young woman, Gabriella, coming to her studio on the dock there, asking Celine to help find her father, who went missing over 20 years ago, near Yellowstone National Park, assumed to be a bear, ruled to be a bear mauling, but the body was never found. So that's how it starts. And I actually started the novel with this young woman's story. And I write, you know, I've been a poet my whole life, and I'm almost more interested in the music of the language than the story, than the plot. And so I always start with the first line, and I let the music of the first line carry me into the story. And this first line was, let me see if I can remember, it was something like, "My mother's name is Amana Ambrosio. In Tupi Warani, Amana means night rain." And I just liked the sound of it. And that led me into the story of Gabriella, who had lost her father. And before you know it, right in chapter one, this young woman was contacting someone named Celine, who was a lot like my mother. And it was just then that I realized that what I really wanted to do was spend another year with my mom, you know, after she died. And I think that was the impetus for the book. I got to sit down for 8 or 9 months and just spend every day with her. And I wrote her as closely as I could in terms of how she thought, how she spoke, her family history. But, you know, this case, this young woman bringing the case, that was all fiction. And I had so much fun sort of getting in the truck with someone like my mom and someone who was a lot like her husband, Pete, who really exists. Pete Beveridge is a old Mainer who doesn't say much. We call the quiet American. They're like good cop, bad cop. The cop who talks and the cop who doesn't say a word. And I'd get in the truck with these guys and go on this, you know, totally fictional case. And that was fun for me, too, because I never knew what was going to happen.
Yeah, you start the book, you come in kind of sideways to it with this Gabriella character, but you don't even start with her. You start with the guy who just happens to be at the beach and sees her coming down. And one of the things I like that you do in this book is you kind of switch points of view and to come up with this female character. And you spend a lot of time with Celine, but you move around quite a bit. How did you decide to come into this story? Because you come in at a slant. Is that just how you felt? Like you wanted to?
I always come in at a slant. It's because I don't know, have any idea what I'm doing. I mean, really, you know, writers, especially in France, I spent a month last September all in France. Writers love to talk about all the stuff that they meant to do, and I don't really mean to do anything. And I think the other guys are lying. I think most of us just sit down and write, and it's sort of like, you know, you've trained enough, you've written so many stories, you've read so much that I think you've decided a lot what you're going to do, you know, unconsciously in your sleep. And so, I started with that scene on Big Sur because. Really, I liked the wind going over all those beautiful poppies and the flower, you know, the swaths of lupin, the blue lupin and the orange poppies and the cliffs and the water crashing against the rocks. And I just sort of wanted to be there. I just thought that was a cool place to go. So I started the story there.
Well, you have a real love of nature writing. I mean, you get Yellowstone and the previous two novels. There's a lot of nature. I mean, that seems like home base almost for you, you know, to have a physical description or of a place, of a particular
character. Yeah, I just like being in nature. And, if nothing else works, might as well go fishing. But not just fishing, but, you know, be in nature. I always get happy when I'm writing about it.
We're live at the Boulder Bookstore today at the Radio Book Club, which is a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU, Arsene Kashkashian with the Bookstore. As always, we're co-hosting, and this is a special edition because we're actually, as I said, live at the bookstore. And Peter Heller is returning to the book club again. He was previously a guest when he spoke about his other novel, The Painter, and actually that character... There's a mention of him in here. Is that just a little wink because these characters stay in your head long after you've finished the book?
Brief.
Another character mentions him as a friend or something.
Yeah, I got a call yesterday from a backcountry pilot named Dave Horner in Montana. He said, yeah, a friend of mine just read Celine and said I'm in the book, and I was trying to remember where it was. And then I did. But he was in the Dog Stars, too.
Yeah.
And I think it's really fun to...
So do these characters then just live on? They obviously have a life after you've finished.
Yeah, it's busy at my house when the lights go out.
Especially this, because there's so much of your family in Celine, obviously based on your mother. And it's a real thriller. I mean, there's a plot that is, you know, page turning at its utmost, because there's a whole backstory to what happened to Gabriella's father, and Celine and Pete go looking for the truth. But at the same time, there's so much discovery about Celine, and so many people are also finding their own truths. Pete, her husband, acknowledges there's so much that he doesn't know about his wife. Hank, her son, whom I'm assuming is based on you, is also on his own quest to find out about his mother's backstory. And so there's all these different people on their own journeys of discovery. I mean, was that difficult to kind of keep everything at the same time, because there's flashbacks and different periods of time, particularly with Celine's story, we go back and forth a lot.
Yeah. No, I don't think so. I mean, I sort of, you know, I learned how to do that writing nonfiction. So for instance, like in The Whale Wars, it's about Sea Shepherd, and there's a lot of exposition that you want to put in there about, you know, the International Whaling Commission and the moratorium on whaling and the history of whaling and the, but you can't lay it, you can't put it all in big blocks because your reader will fall asleep. So you have to ladle it in and mix it up with the adventure and maybe do a portrait of somebody on the way. And so I got used to sort of mixing up elements of a story to keep a reader interested, and it keeps me interested too. And so I never outline, but I find, after writing so many nonfiction stories and books, that when I get to a place where I'm sort of getting a little bit tired of a certain storyline or a certain character, it's like, okay, let's put that to rest and shift to something else, hopscotch to something else. It's just a way for me to feel interested and follow my nose into new parts of the story.
Yeah, the story was almost equal Hank's quest to figure out what his mother's background was. He finds out from a dying aunt that he had an older sister who was put up for adoption. And it seems like Celine's grief over this is partly what drives her career, you know, and that she's always looking for missing people. She's looking for, because she was never able to get together with her daughter, really, it seems like.
Yeah, sure. I think that is the impulse for her reuniting, you know, looking for missing people and reuniting birth families. And I wonder if also it's sort of like that storyline grew out of my own grief, wanting to find my mom again, you know?
Yeah, now, if there is a grief as a driver in the story. Celine's two sisters have recently died when the story ends, and you feel like that's driving her. She's got emphysema, she's walking around with oxygen when she needs it, and yet she wants one last, or maybe not one last, but one more adventure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
so,
right.
I was wondering if you could read a piece that kind of helps give the readers some real insight into Celine. I wouldn't call Celine somebody who is too much in her head. She's really a person of action, but in this part, she really starts getting into her head about why she does what she does, or starts thinking about it in a more in-depth way, I think.
Sure. It occurred to her, I should say that they're up in, they're in Cook City, Montana, which is not really a city. In fact, it only has one street, and it's dusk. Or it's night. It's just getting to be night. It occurred to her as they walked that they were looking for a father who had disappeared more than two decades ago, but that he had truly left his child's life long before that, that the young woman had grown up, for all intents and purposes, fatherless, as she did. That finding him now might resolve something in the woman's heart, but would not change the essential sadness. And that was the business she was in. She had had to accept it long ago, that her job was enabling just such reunions, that though they could not change someone's childhood, still, there was a great raw need in her clients to know their parents and to meet them again. There was something in that resolution that was very important to the child and often to the parent. She certainly knew about that. And sometimes they, the parent and the child, started again. Rarely did it work, but sometimes it did. And then a child would have a mother, and a mother a daughter. The saddest part was that parents would keep disappearing, and children would cry themselves to sleep night after night, for months, for years, and that mothers would have their babies taken from them before they had a chance to smell the tuft of soft hair, their ears, before they had a chance to say, "Oh, how I love you, forever and ever." That the baby was taken before she had a chance to kiss her and wrap her properly in her arms. Pete guided her around a deep pothole, partly filled with gravel, and she gripped his hand more tightly. In the wan light from the motel sign, she could see their truck, the only vehicle in the drive, the only guess. At the end of the street, she could see the dark bulk of the baronet rising against the night sky. Yes, sad, how it felt. She thought that one might not make a dent in the great sadness, but one could help make another person whole.
That's Pete Heller reading from his book Celine, which is his latest novel, and he's our guest today on the Radio Book Club, a monthly collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. We're actually taping this particular episode of the book club at the Boulder Bookstore, so it's an exciting opportunity for us to get out of the studio. And that last part, it's so poignant, it really refers to the baby that Celine gave up for adoption, which happened when she was, I think, 15. She was certainly, mm-hmm. she was in school at the time. So much of this is influenced by your mother. That didn't happen to your mom, but that happened to one of her sisters. Is that right?
am I allowed to say this?
Oh, okay. If not, that's fine.
Something similar happened to one of her sisters. Yeah.
we don't want to get you in any trouble. You know,
right. But. And I should say, you know, the whole book isn't like depressing and sad and full of grief. I mean, it's just a hoot. You know, a lot of it is just so fun. You know, they drive past the Double Up Motel in Lander, Wyoming, and Celine says to Pete that that's a good name because there are probably a bunch of patrons in those rooms doing stuff they doubly ought not to do. That's my favorite joke in the whole book.
Maybe you could tell us about Celine. Celine is a little bit of an action hero, too. I mean, here right. she is. She's wheeling, you know, she's not wheeling, but she's got her oxygen with her if she needs it. And she ends up in a bar with a bunch of bikers. And she doesn't like how the bikers are treating the waitress. Maybe you could tell what happens in that scene.
There's a guy with spider web tattoos on his elbows. And just a really mean-looking dude, and he grabs the young waitress by her collar and pulls her toward him. And Celine just gets up and taps him on the back, and he turns around ready to fight. But she's so petite, and my mom really was petite, that he can't see anybody until he looks down. And he's like, sort of like, "Granny, back off." And she says, basically, you know, "I don't think we ought to treat young women like that. Is that the only way you can get attention?" Kind of reminds me of somebody leading our country right now. The guy gets, you know, infuriated and whips out a clasp knife, opens up a flip knife, and asks her if she'd like to die, he could help her with that. And she says, "Just a second." She asks Pete for her oxygen condenser. She says to the biker, "Just a minute." She takes bunch of breaths on the oxygen, but the guy's just like, all of a sudden his warrior spirit is deflated, but she knows how to get it back. She hands back the oxygen, and then she tells him that he better apologize to the woman. And she steps back because she's thinking, if I have to draw down on this guy, I don't want it to be within reach, because she's well trained. And he's thinking she's, you know, scared. He says, "That's right, Granny, you know." And now the whole biker bar is looking at her, and, you know, he basically says, you know, "Do you want to die?" She looks around, she says, "I'm already dead." And just the whole bar, it's like, these are warriors, you know, these are like sons of silence, and a warrior recognizes a warrior, and they just, you know, all of a sudden, you know, they're not having fun anymore, and they basically leave the bar. It was a really fun scene to write, because I could see my mom doing that, you know. My mom, when her cousin was dying up in Harlem at St. Luke's, this was in the 70s, she went up to say goodbye to him, and she left at like 2 in the morning, and it was a completely deserted Amsterdam Avenue, and the wind's blowing, and clip, clack, clack her pumps down the street, and all alone, and these two big guys jumped out of a doorway. And this is a true story. Mom looked up at the one guy and said, "You know, you must be freezing. It is so cold out here. Your shirt's all ripped. Let me see if I have a safety pin." She opened up her purse. She started, you know, rifling through, found a safety pin, and she was an artist, so she's really good with her hand. You know, she folded it over really carefully, the edges, and pinned it, and pinned the other side, and said, "Now you're going to be a lot warmer." And the guys were like so dumbstruck that they insisted on, they said, "You know, this is a really dangerous neighborhood. You really should, what are you doing here by yourself? And we'll wait, you know, we'll walk you, we'll get you a taxi." No taxi would stop because they looked so menacing. So she finally just said, "You know, you guys were going to go off to do something. Why don't you go do it? I'll be fine." And she got a ride home. But that's the way she was. You know, she was really ice, you know, cool cookie.
There was loads of vignettes like that that really just built up the character of Celine. And there's one particular one with Bruce Willis.
That was true.
It was actually true.
She was rolling her bag through the airport through JFK, and she was struggling a little bit with another bag, and all of a sudden a hand came, took the handle, took the other bag off her shoulder, said, "Allow me." And she looked up, and it was Bruce Willis. He was a lot younger. He wasn't, I don't know if he was completely bald back then. And so they got the, they were chatting, and they got to the counter, and then my mom had to check, she had to check in her Glock, which she was packing in her check bag, and Bruce Willis, you know, this, she's very petite, genteel little woman, you know, he was like so taken aback that this woman was checking Glock. He got his signature smile, you know, the one, not the one before he blows you away, but the one when he's kind of amused, and gave her his card and said, you know, if you're ever in LA, you know, you and your husband, you know, look me up and everything, and that was that. But she said her gun went missing because there were so many people crowding around to see Bruce Willis, and the New York Police Department was about to get issued Glocks, so the cops in the airport were interested to see it too. And when she arrived in wherever she was going, I think it was Maine, her gun was gone out of her bag. And she always ascribed that to the fuss and bother that fame brought people. She described that, and so she always told me, you know, if you be really good at what you do, but if you happen to be one of the best in the world, just don't let too many people know it. Mm. And I thought that was wonderful advice.
One of your characters we haven't really touched upon much because it's so much fun talking about your mother, but one of the characters who's missing, who sets everything in action, is, had been a National Geographic photographer from the 70s and did all this amazing photography, and now he's gone missing, and it's his daughter that sets things in motion by going to Celine. And you know, here's a guy, he's kind of a rough-hewn guy who's very handsome and rugged and does all this amazing photography all over the world, and he seemed more like a typical Peter Heller character in a way. And what was your impetus for him and you know, really, you know, coming up with this whole photography background?
I've had to work with a lot of photographers, you know, doing my stories for magazines, and he was sort of an amalgamation of a few of the guys that I met. Adventure photographers tend to be kind of rugged, and they tend to be loners, and that's the way this guy was.
Yeah, he was a loner after, you know, the opening scene. I don't want to give any too much away, but the opening scene, his wife dies, and that devastates him, and that really causes him to be a loner, even though he's got an 8-year-old daughter.
Right.
And that's when you read about sometimes he physically leaves when she's older, but he really left her when she was 8. And was he going back to his loner self, do you think? Or it was his wife that drew him out, and that was a temporary thing, and he was more back to himself, or just so devastated?
I think he got into a trap when his marriage with this, you know, he married, he was so devastated by losing his wife that he sort of took the next life ring that floated his way, and it was a bad marriage, and there was no way out of it except to disappear, which I think was very hard on his daughter. And Celine recognizes that his choice to do that was a bad choice. It made him a bad father. And it was weak in a way to just retreat. But I think this is one of these guys who feels more comfortable in a cabin in Montana by himself than in a bad marriage in the city trying to raise a kid.
And Celine's reaction to the whole situation is very much informed by her own relationship, or lack of, with her own father,
right,
who also disappeared. And she's very angry at these men who abandoned,
right,
their kids.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was that true? Was that your grandfather?
My grandfather was a very reserved man. And he sort of, once he became divorced from my grandmother, he sort of abdicated, you know, raising the kids. And they loved spending time with him, but they rarely got to.
Well, the one scene you have with Celine and her father when she's like a teenager, and they're kind of playing this game, and they look out the window, they're in Manhattan, and it turns out to be this like showgirl who's one of the father's lovers, and she's just so enraged because, you know, it's hard for him to get one day every 3 months with her.
Right.
And this showgirl comes in and says, hey, you haven't called me in a week.
Right. Very hard for this young girl who's, I think she was like 14. Yeah, very painful. And my grandfather, you know, this guy, Harry Watkins, we do draw on. I mean, I especially draw on my family for this story. And he was a kind of a rogue. I really liked the guy. I really did. He had his own kind of very quiet charm. He was a natural athlete. He loved to surf cast off of Montauk. He was a very smart guy, but he was reserved. And I think coming up, you know, before I actually knew him, I think he was a real ladies' man. And I think he hurt his family.
Mm-hmm. There are so many more stories, I'm sure, to tell about your mother and everything you had, you know, growing up and her experience. And the end of the book really feels like waiting for the next Celine book. And in fact, it feels like there could be a whole series here. I want to know so much more about Celine and have her adventures. Do you think this is just the start of something? Or is this just, you know, a once-off thing because it was very much informed by your own grief about your mom?
Well, there's a lot of more stories to tell, you know, about mom and her family and stuff and the fictional character Celine. So I couldn't rule it out. It's like asking a president, you know, it's like asking a senator if they're going to run for president in a way. It's like, I wouldn't rule it out. But, you know, James Lee Burke is one of my favorite authors. He wrote that detective series in New Orleans and Louisiana, the Dave Robichaux detective series. And I think one thing that happened to him is people loved his first Dave Robichaux novel so much. He got so much pressure to do again and again and again. And now he's got, you know, a dozen of them. And I think it was sort of a trap for him. I don't want to do that. But I could sort of see every few years writing another Celine Watkins mystery. It would be so fun.
And how did writing this book help you in your bereavement and the grieving process after your mom died?
Yeah, it was very cathartic. I mean, for me, I think by the time I finished the book, I felt like I was closer to my mom, you know, than I've been in maybe ever, because I was very close with her. But writing the book allowed me to delve into her childhood in a way that, even though it was imaginary, it's so interesting. I mean, it's so interesting how writing novels work, because even though you're embarking into this world of the imagination, as you're writing it and as you go home at night and think about it, it feels real. Jasper the dog, who was Higgs' dog in the Dog Stars, feels to me like a dog that I had that's gone now. He lives in my heart there. And so writing this book about my mother, you know, spending 8 months with her felt like I had actually just spent eight months, you know, every day with my mom. And it was really wonderful. It's very, very, it's a real salve, yeah.
Well, Peter Heller has been our guest on the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. In fact, we're live at the Boulder Bookstore taping this. It's been real fun to actually get out of the studio. And Peter, this your second visit to the book club. I can't wait for the next book. Are you working on something right now?
Oh, yeah.
Always.
Yeah, I think we're going back to the more male roots. Arson, don't worry.
I'm not worried. I mean, I really enjoyed the variety of your career, and I wouldn't want you to write 10 Celine books in a row.
I wouldn't mind her coming back.
I don't want it to be like Sue Grafton, where we get, you know, Z is for Celine or something or whatever, right. You know.
Well, we're going to have a bit more content and a bit more discussion with Peter Heller. Invite questions from our audience here on After Hours at the Book Club, which is a special podcast edition of this. So do subscribe on iTunes. Find us at kgnu.org. But in the meantime, Peter Heller, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. It's so fun.
And as we always do at the end of every book club edition, we announce the next book that we're inviting everyone to read along with us. Now, this is also a real adventure-packed book, but it's not fiction at all, and it's going to really resonate with our Colorado listeners.
Well, I came up with this book, which is Land on Fire by Gary Ferguson. It's a nonfiction book about wildfire in the West. And I kind of thought about this book because in March, I looked up. I live downtown in Boulder, and I looked up, and there was smoke. And it smelled like smoke. And then there is this book talking about the new reality of wildfires in the West. And so Ferguson's a real expert on this. He's based in Montana. He's done a lot of work. There's a lot of pictures, so it's kind of fun. It's our first picture book. But I think it'd be a fascinating topic. And there's a picture I'll show to the studio audience of Boulder with a fire raging. And so I think, you know, this is a really important topic, and I'm hoping that it'll be a great conversation.
Well, do read along with us, and then we'll be discussing that book on the fourth Thursday of June.
Yes.
And we'll have our full schedule at kgnu.org. Thanks so much, Arson Kashkashian, and I'm Maeve Conran.